Good morning, all. Today is a meeting of the Finance and Budget Committee post-approval of the FY19 operating and capital budget. We have a number of items on the agenda today. I hope the four members of the committee have had a chance to look over the agenda, and assuming that they did, I'll entertain a motion to approve the agenda.
So moved.
Second, so moved. All in favor, say aye, aye. All right, and you've had a chance to review the minutes of the March 8th meeting. I'll entertain a motion for approval of those minutes.
So moved.
All in favor on the committee, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Very good. Good morning. Now that we have the agenda and minutes approved, I'd like to give you an overview of today's business before the Finance Committee. The first item on our agenda is for board approval of a permanent U-Pass program. This program, which provides discounted, unlimited ride passes for full-time college students in the area, has had a successful pilot, and staff now seeks to make it permanent. Second is the authorization for the general manager to negotiate and execute an agreement with the District of Columbia for changes to the Kids Ride Free program to improve its structure and utilization for the next year and for succeeding years. Third, our third action is to increase the capital improvement program budget for the Potomac Yard Station, which is a reimbursable project, and authorize the general manager to enter into a project agreement with the City of Alexandria to fund this project. The project, which is being fully funded by the City of Alexandria, will allow for the station project to proceed to final design and construction. And the last item on our agenda today is an update from our consultant and staff on the status of Metro's other post-employment benefit, or OPEB, programs, the upcoming changes to OPEB reporting guidelines, and Metro's progress in establishing an OPEB trust. So I will welcome Mr. Anasecki to provide a description and discussion for the U-Pass program, and we'll then vote on each item in turn. Thank you. Mr. Anasecki, Mr. Wiedefeld.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. And thank you. Good morning to members of the committee. Today's staff is returning to the committee seeking board, committee approval for a permanent U-Pass program. This comes after a successful two-year pilot, as the chairman mentioned, during which over 10,000 students from 11 universities enrolled in the program, generating additional ridership and revenue for Metro. A quick review of how we got to this point. The board, as you recall, authorized the U-Pass program in March of 2016. Both as a ridership as well as a customer service initiative with colleges and universities in the region. Last year, American University became the first institution to launch the U-Pass pilot. And then in March of FY 2017, the board extended the pilot for another year, enabling Metro to enroll an additional 10 universities covering over 500 additional students who are attending satellite programs in the DC region. As we noted when the board established the pilot program, U-Pass benefits students, universities, and Metro itself. For students, U-Pass offers a group discounted fare media for unlimited rides on Metro during the academic year. And through the U-Pass program, colleges and universities can provide low-cost transit passes to their students, just $1 a day per student, made possible through the bulk purchasing of fare media. And for Metro itself, we benefit from U-Pass through increased ridership, as I indicated earlier, or rather increased revenue, but more pointedly through increased ridership, which Metro is able to provide at a low marginal cost. The concept of the U-Pass is not unique to Metro. as this slide shows, it isn't used across the nation, with over 20 transit agencies partnering with more than 200 colleges and universities to provide discounted fares to students. And here at Metro, the UPass pilot program has generated, as you can see from this slide, over 2 million rides on both Metro Bus and Metro Rail since its inception, and has also brought in $5.4 million in revenue over this timeline. As this slide shows, UPass mode distribution, which is on the left, is similar to Metro's normal ridership pattern, which is displayed on the right. But the real story is on the next slide, which shows that a majority of UPass trips take place during Metro's non-peak hours. As this slide shows, 60% of Metro of UPass trips, which is on the bar on the left, take place during off-peak periods when Metro, Boston Metro Rail, has capacity. That means that Metro does not have to add additional capacity or manpower in order to provide these trips. Over the past 2 years, Metro has promoted UPass at various forums, including college campuses, lunch and learn events attended by over 50 student representatives from regional schools, and a scavenger hunt that started the FY17-18 school year. And as a result of those efforts, Metro was able to add these 11 colleges so far in 2018. And more interestingly, Metro continues, the good news rather, is that Metro continues to get interest and inquiries from universities. The slide shows a list of prospective schools that have, including Northern Virginia Community College to Gallaudet University, that have lately shown interest in the UPass program. Collectively, the schools represent an estimated 100,000 students, and Metro's goal is to enroll every college and university in this region. So any assistance that the committee members can provide will be helpful in meeting this goal. Mr. Chairman, with that, staff requests committee approval to make this program permanent and with opportunities to grow the program through regional partnerships. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Second, as I indicated in the introduction, we'll take up each of these items that require a vote in turn with discussion first by members of the committee and then by other board members, and then I'll ask for a motion for approval and any amendments that are appropriate. Just to start things off, on just going back to your slide on ridership and revenue, I think that was number six. I believe, keep going back. Stop. Thank you. Just for clarification, this chart shows ridership and revenue for a two-year period each.
So that's accurate.
Okay. And it also shows that the ridership seems to be higher in the fall semester and then lower in the spring semester for each year. Is that because students can opt out in the spring semester, or is there some explanation why the participation by students seems to decline in the spring semester as opposed to the fall semester?
Mr. Goldman, the trend that we've seen, not just here, but around the nation, is that the enrollment in colleges and therefore in UPass programs tend to be higher in the fall. And as the semester proceeds, some students tend to make alternative choices, and that impacts ultimately the enrollment in the program itself.
So students can actually opt out at American University for the spring semester?
No, sir. You cannot opt out of this program, but you can choose to go to a different school or to...
Okay. So it's more maybe a function of students with programs abroad for the spring semester rather
Correct.
Than... an option for students to actually opt out of the program and reduce participation and
That's correct.
Modest revenue.
That's correct.
Thank you.
I do think large dependent
That's from your own personal experience, right?
12?
you must be an NCAA star to be there for 12 years. Mr. McMillan, I believe you have an observation and perhaps a proposal.
Sure. Looking at the text of the resolution itself, $1 is presumably the price point that makes sense with the discussions with currently participating schools and others you're seeking to attract into the program. But given that this is a permanent authority we're talking about here, is locking in $1 as the price point for the next 5, 10, 20, 30 years the best way for us to do, as this is drafted, as I understand it, if $125 turns out to be the right price point 10 years down the road, you got to come back to the board for a change. Do we need that level of specificity in the resolution? Would it be appropriate to give management a little more flexibility on negotiating the appropriate price point?
Thank you so much for pointing it out. The intent is to provide a general manager with general broad authorization, but with the goal of negotiating subsequent changes in pricing without coming back to the board. But if that's the way this is drafted, I apologize for that, because that's not the intent.
Now, it's drafted that you would come back to the board if you wanted to change from a dollar. That's how I read it?
Yeah, that was not the intent.
Okay.
That's how I read it as well, if I can.
Okay. I don't know if we need to do anything now, but if we can look at the phrasing of that particular part before this goes to full board approval.
I was going to suggest that one way to approach it, and you may want to consider this, is in that whereas, to use the phrase, participation in the program will be no less than $1 a day, which would give you a floor and allow the general manager to negotiate.
And maybe just some reporting requirement if you're changing the price or something. Yeah. Okay. I don't think drafting it here orally is the best approach, but maybe we can figure that out between now and the full board.
Mr. Corcoran?
In a recent conversation, I think I learned that we are actively pursuing other schools to adopt this in the region, but that they have concerns having a forced fee onto their annual fee because it makes them look bad relative to other colleges if someone is at home doing a price comparison. Is that correct?
I think every university has a different, they look at this differently based on their financials and whatever their strategy is. So, yeah, that is one example that I've heard as well.
So you would ask for some help from board members. What help could we actually provide in doing this? Because I think it's instant ridership if we are able to implement this with the universities. So is it the setting up of appointments help?
The committee members and others have strong alliances and relationships with some of these institutions, and sometimes it takes a different level of conversation to convince these universities or colleges about the value that this program brings to them. So I think the addition of your voice may be helpful in increasing participation in the program.
Mr. Dorsey, I forgot to recognize you as a member
of
the committee first.
It's okay. I don't stand on ceremony. It's all good. To speak to Mr. Corcoran's point real quickly, I know that that's an impediment that you all have reached it with some of the universities that you've negotiated with. Still, others have found that being able to tie a mandatory fee to a real tangible benefit, like you can ride transit for free, has really been a huge sell. So it enables them to go beyond fees, which just seem arbitrary, to actually delivering real benefit for students. So it'll probably be as appealing to some places as it is discouraging to others. My question, and I thank Mr. McMillan for bringing up the resolve clause, and thank you for addressing it. I do have a question about the last resolve clause in the resolution, about the status of your negotiations with jurisdictional transit providers to link or expand the UPass program to work on regional transit systems. If you can give us a sense of where you are with that, because as you certainly well know, there are a number of universities where the students are actually based in the jurisdictions and may, in fact, rely on those local transit providers for most of their transit needs.
Thank you, sir. We believe that the broader this program can operate, the more valuable it will be to each student. As a pilot, we wanted to understand how Metro can provide this service to the universities that are willing to participate in. Now, in a permanent program, we think that providing access to the broader areas that Metro serves will actually increase the value. And so far, the conversations with some of these regional service providers have been positive. We do not have any agreement yet, but we believe that those universities will be able to, and those regional providers will be able to participate, just like we do with the regular Smart Trip card. We share the rights and we share the revenues. That will be the same concept here.
And will that require any technological enhancements that are significant? I don't know really how the UPass card works.
It does not require any additional cost or enhancement.
Terrific. Thank you.
Yeah, just to underscore Mr. Rosie's point, that seems to be an issue with an institution like Montgomery College, where students are locally based and they're riding on the local ride-on system as well as the Metro system. So you have to have an agreement with the ride-on system if you're going to have a viable UPass program that's attractive to something like that. I'm sorry?
Montgomery College students ride ride-on for free.
Yeah, so there's your conundrum. There's your challenge. Mr. Evans, anything? Mr. Bulger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for the presentation. The University of the District of Columbia, I didn't see that on the list. Are they in or out of this UPass program?
We've had several conversations with the University of the District of Columbia. They have not made the decision yet to participate.
All right, any other questions, comments, discussions on the UPass? All right, then I think what I propose to do is entertain a motion to approve the resolution as it's currently framed. We'll give staff and the lawyers some chance over the next 2 weeks to come up with an amendment to that resolution, which will then be presented as an amendment by the chair at the full meeting of the board in 2 weeks. So I would entertain a motion from one of the members of the committee to approve the resolution and approve a long-term approval authorization for the UPass program.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor, signify by saying aye. Committee members only, aye.
Aye.
Very good. All right, that takes care of UPass. We will move on to Kids Ride Free.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, again. This next agenda item, 6, committee authorization to modify WMATA's Kids Ride Free partnership with the district in order to improve program administration and utilization. As background, Metro and the district have long had a partnership providing discounted transit services to high school students in the district. Over the years, the program has been modified to add Metro Rail, to include summer school students, and to accommodate changes in fare media technology. In the FY18 fiscal year, Metro expects to provide about 10 million trips under this program, with 66% of those trips taking place on Metro bus. And based on a negotiated agreement with the district, Metro expects to receive about $19 million for the program in this fiscal year. If you go to the next slide, two specific changes for the program will provide active smart trip cards to students to ride Metro. And the second change being proposed will eliminate geographic restrictions on the program. The current VC1 fare media requires students to tap twice to upload the card, to upload the pass rider on their cards. which means that the students are delayed in their ability to use the pass immediately with school starting. And the geographic limits creates negative values on the cards that causes fare disputes with customers and bus operators, particularly. So these changes are part of Metro's broader efforts to get all riders to tap and ride and to capture every ride on Metro. And along with securing the swing gates, these changes will reduce fare disputes and facilitate accurate data collection, which could ultimately increase Metro's federal grant allocations. With that, Mr. Chairman, staff request committee approval of the resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Anasecki. I just have one question to start off, and I'll make one observation. When the ridership and revenue chart, I think it's chart three. I just want to make sure I'm reading this correctly, because you're showing about 10 million one-way trips, and you're showing $19 million in revenue. So do I correctly read that, that the yield per trip, per student trip, is about $2? Is that the correct way to read the numbers that you're presenting?
That's accurate. And part of that is because, as you know, we do not have all participants in these programs tapping, so we've made some estimates and projections in terms of what ridership could be.
So that was the follow-up question. So the 9 million, the 9.7 million projected bus and rail riders total, those are tap-ins plus some projection, or those are actually taps, either payments to the bus driver and taps into the rail system? That's what I'm trying to understand. What exactly is this number?
Right. That number is inclusive of actual taps on both bus and rail, indications from the bus operator on bus by use of the 8-key, as well as estimates of rail utilization for folks simply flashing their passes.
All right, so it's a fairly solid number.
It's a fairly reasonable.
Reasonable number. All right. The other observation I just wanted to make is that this has obviously been a very controversial program, and you're going through some changes here, and I just want all the board members and members of the committee to be aware that the resolution calls for the general manager to come back and provide us a annual report each year on what's happened in the program and what changes are anticipated for the future year, so that the committee and board members will have an opportunity to understand where this program is directed and going, and if they have any concerns, they'll be in a position to provide some advice to the general manager before he executes a contract for each of the subsequent years. But the action we're taking, the way the resolution is currently drafted, will be a approval for the general manager to engage in contracts with the District of Columbia for future years without limitation. We're essentially shifting this from a pilot to a more long-term authorization for the general manager. Other questions? Mr. Dorsey?
Thank you.
Mr. McMillan?
Question. So the program eliminates geographical restrictions. I wonder, are there either in the current or newly proposed program time of day or day of week restrictions, or is this a 24/7 pass that's available to students?
It is 24/7.
Okay. And then?
Similar to the U-Pass.
Right. Okay. And then the data points from the last presentation about share of peak versus off-peak I thought was very attractive for UPass. Do you have, was your word reasonable estimates in this program? How many are peak versus off-peak rides?
I don't have that with me, but please keep in mind that we've got a couple of factors here that we don't have with respect to UPass. UPass, we have actual data that allows us to make, to provide you with that information. We've made some projections here, but we believe they're reasonable. We do not have the capacity to provide some information that you're looking for.
Okay. Yeah, I assume morning is peak and there's kind of a mix depending on after school activities. I don't know.
All right.
Anyway. All right, thank you.
Mr. Evans? Other members of the board, questions?
Mr. Lobby?
Thank you. Just one question. Looking at the cost structure here, doing the quick math, it looks like for Kids Rights Free, it's about $1.98 that we that is returned on each trip. And looking at the U-Pass program, it's like $2.39. Why is there a difference in the recovery rate on those? Are those negotiated numbers or what?
They're both negotiated numbers, but they're also different programs. U-Pass, you have the entire population participating, and there's a different level of both data accuracy and utilization that we're seeing there versus the students that we don't know, Kids Right Free, that we're not seeing, but we're not capable of seeing at this point. That said, I mean, those numbers are relatively close to each other, which is part of the reason why we want to treat them the same way, offer the same media, provide timely access to the system, and ultimately unify and streamline the administrative processes around both of those. So we believe that using that same structure will be positive for Metro and the customers.
One follow-up question. Do we have like a revenue target on this, a number that we try to achieve with these programs, cost or revenue recovery per trip?
Overall goal as an organization is to continue to improve the recovery rate, to improve the recovery ratio. So as a proposition, all of the more riders we get without increasing cost is net positive to this organization. And that's what both the U-Pass and we believe to some degree what the Kids Right Free program does.
But you don't have that number where that break-even point where we can provide good service without additional cost?
I do not have that with me here.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? None? Entertain a motion from a member of the committee. A second? All in favor of moving the long-term authorization for the Kids Ride Free program to the board level, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Very good. It's done. All right. We'll move on across the river to Alexandria, a new face, Mr. Webster, Mr. Thomas, to talk about a Potomac Yard station. Gentlemen.
Morning. Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's exciting to be here today to talk about the Potomac Yard Station project. We're at a pretty significant milestone in the project, which brings us here today. So we're here to obtain approval from the board to increase the Potomac Yard Station project budget by $279 million for design and construction, to authorize the general manager to negotiate and execute a funding agreement between Metro and the City of Alexandria, and to amend the capital improvement program budget. Right, there we go. So we thought we'd give you a little bit of background without too detailed, but in October 2008, the city came to us and asked us to establish a reimbursable project to design and construct an infill station between National and Braddock Road stations. We had our first board action in February of 2009, which was to establish that reimbursable project, and we put together an initial budget of $1.5 million. Subsequently, we've been back to the board to increase that budget to $11 million as we advance the project through preliminary design. We've had to perform an environmental impact statement, as well as go through our procurement process. As part of that, we went to the board in December of 2015, which was at the end of the WMATA Compact public hearing process. At that hearing in December, or at the board in December, we asked the board to approve the public hearing staff report, the board to select the preferred alternative, At that time, we added the station to the adopted regional system, which actually puts it into the network, and approved our authority to acquire property. So where we are today is we have a total estimated project budget of $290 million for WMATA. The city took an action at its council on Tuesday night to approve its, the overall project budget that includes WMATA's costs as well as the city's costs. We're near the end of our procurement process, so we are fairly confident in that number, both for our number as well as the city's numbers. We don't have a final number, but we were close enough that we're comfortable with where we are. So we have to amend the WMATA CIP in the project budget so we can award the contract. We have a contract duration. We anticipate issuing notice to proceed to that contract here early in the summer for about a 3.5-year contract. So sometime in the middle part of FY22, right now technically it's December of 21, we will be having a ribbon cutting ceremony to open up the new station. So with that, we're recommending that the board approve the increase of the Potomac Yard Station project budget by $279 million for design and construction, that the board authorize the general manager CEO to negotiate and execute a funding agreement with the City of Alexandria, and that we amend the capital improvement program.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Exciting project going forward. You mentioned in your statement that there's some difference in numbers, that the number approved by the City of Alexandria was somewhat larger than the amount that you're presenting as the cost of the project of $281 million. Can you just explain what those difference numbers are and what the $280 million is buying?
So the WMATA budget of $290 million will be the contract amount plus it includes the costs we've incurred already within the $11 million budget, plus the soft costs and consultant costs and other follow-on contract costs that will incur as the project goes on. For example, follow-on costs or fare collection, we don't put those into our station contracts. The IT equipment and all of the security equipment, we don't put into our design-build contracts. We do those as follow-on contracts. So it's an assembly of all of those various costs for that WMATA is going to incur as the manager of the contract. The city has additional costs for their oversight of the project, as well as some mitigation costs that came out of the environmental impact statement process, working with, in this case, the National Park Service.
So, Mr. Goldman, if I could, we also have a contingency in there as well.
I'm sorry, you have a contingency? Over the $290 million, and that's what brings it up to 320?
Yeah, there's contingency within the WMATA budget, and the city also has some contingency as well.
All right. You mentioned things like, I guess, fare gates and fare card machines. Are they included within the 290, or are you saying you're going to have to come back to us for another increase for some other capital expenditures over the next 2-3 years?
No, they are within the 290. The fare collection, the security, the IT equipment, that's all within the 290. That's all in WMATA budget.
Thank you. Mr. Dorsey?
No, sir.
Mr. Pillen? No. Mr. Evans, other members of the board?
Hopefully before the 22nd, but at this point we are a little behind because of some things that we've had to deal with, and to no one's fault. We'll make sure it's yes. We'll have a shovel.
You want a gold-plated shovel, or will you take? I think I have a question for Mr. Webster. I guess there are other costs that will be required of the board down the line in terms of increased operating costs. Could you just, for the record, state what those are and when the board will have to, and the Finance Committee will have to deal with those increased operating costs?
Yes, of course. When the station opens to revenue service in the FY2022 timeframe, Metro will have costs for operating and maintaining the facility. We're estimating preliminary basis that those will be in the range of $2 to $3 million. At the time time the station opens, we'll also start collecting revenue. Initial, very early estimates of about $1 to $2 million, resulting in a subsidy of impact of about $1 to $2 million at that time. So, leading into the FY 2022 budget process, we would bring that forward to the committee
at that time and not before. It would be triggered by when the station opens.
That's correct.
There would be no run-up prior to the actual opening that there would be costs that would appear in the operating budget.
We would expect those costs, most of the costs, to be borne by the construction project. And just also to note that at the point that those operating costs and operating subsidy are added to the regional metro budget, those would be considered above the 3% operating subsidy cap, as this is a new construction project and in addition to the system.
And what do those $2 to $3 million of course consist of? Is that the staffing the station with a station manager and security and maintenance and things like that? Is that
primary costs are the staffing of the station, janitorial maintenance costs at the station. There'll be some incremental power costs, both for the station itself and as we add a stop and a station to the system, it changes the power draw in the propulsion system. A small amount, but that's an incremental cost.
Thank you.
Just a quick follow-up to that.
Mr. Dorsey?
As part of your projections, does it include the possibility of the general manager's initiatives to maybe look at concessionaire models at new stations? Are your revenue projections offset by any potential revenue enhancements?
Part of the reason for the ranges in the both the expense and the revenue estimates is we have some time to develop strategies for operating the station and for revenue, yes. So.
From what I've seen of the schematics, and maybe Mr. Schmedberg, you can guide me, there are lots of public spaces that people will use to access the station, which may provide opportunity for concessions, for advertising that we don't necessarily get in other stations. So we could see a different model for revenue offsets the increased operating costs here.
Absolutely. It was designed around, because we do have existing public spaces already, and integrating it into that. So very much part of that mix, for sure.
Very good. Any other questions, comments? All right. I'll
move committee recommendation that we approve the increase in the Potomac Yard Station budget to $279 million for design and construction, authorize the GM to negotiate and execute an agreement with the City of Alexandria, and update our CIP.
Could I ask you to just modify that motion to reflect the number of $281 million, which seems to be what's on the list?
That's the number short. Whatever the number is, I modify accordingly.
All right. Did you also include in that motion to increase the capital improvement program by $270 million?
Yes.
Very good. Second?
Second.
All in favor, members of the committee, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Thank you. All right, we've completed the three action items today. We now have a information item, and that's a report on the other post-employment benefits update. So we will welcome someone else to join Mr. Anasecki and Mr. Wiedefeld to the table. Very good. Mr. Anasecki, do you want to introduce your guests and explain the nature of the presentation that you're about to make?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're joined today by Dr.
Thank you very much. For the time to present today. This is an ongoing sort of presentation that we make on a quarterly basis to the committee for WMATA's retirement benefit programs, which includes pensions as well as other post-employment benefit programs. And so today's presentation is about the other post-employment benefit programs, which primarily provide for retiring medical and life insurance benefits to participants. And the focus today, as you can see on this slide, is really around a new accounting pronouncement for Government Accounting Standards number 75 that has been released, which will impact the way WMATA discloses its obligations for the OPEB plan, effective for fiscal 2018. as well as a discussion around the establishment of a trust and fund and seed funding money for the obligations. And prior to getting to that, though, we thought that we would spend a few minutes just to review the overall cost for OPEB plans in general, as well as WMATA's obligations and historical trends. So if you look at this slide, what this actually speaks to is what is the ultimate cost of the plan. And as I mentioned, we're going to speak a little bit about the accounting changes that are going to take place, and sometimes we talk about funding. When we have these conversations, it's important to note that that does not impact what the ultimate cost is. So an ultimate cost of a benefit program then is related to what are the benefits that are being provided, the administrative expenses that are incurred to provide those benefits, and then there are offsetting items to that. The first of those offsetting items is the return on assets that are in a trust related to providing those benefits. And I mention a trust because they have to be specifically earmarked to be able to provide provide those benefits. And the return would be based on whatever it is that the trust earns from its investment strategy. And the other offset to it is the contributions that the retirees are asked to pay in the case of a retiree medical program towards those costs. So while we will talk about the accounting changes, which will demonstrate when these costs are recognized on the financial statements, there may be some conversations around the funding, which actually does impact the ultimate cost because, as I mentioned, the return on assets for those funds does reduce the ultimate cost of the program. On the next slide, we show the historical costs or liability for the WMATA program. And a couple of things to note on this slide. First of all, we do a valuation every other year, so it's not an annual valuation. And so the time periods over which the valuation were done were July 1, 2011, July 1, 2013, 15, and 17. And so you will see that there are some changes that get reflected about a year after the valuation is done because the valuation reflects updated census data, actual claims experience, meaning what the actual costs have been for medical benefits, as well as sort of a projection on what we anticipate future medical costs to rise by. Okay? And so you don't see an immediate impact. So, for example, in 2011, the 2012 was a roll forward. So the first time you really, the 2011 and then the 2012 is when you see that impact. In 2013, you see an impact in 2014 of that valuation. And the question might arise as to why there was a drop from 13 to 14. The drop was primarily due to the fact that medical premiums or expenses incurred costs were a lot better than anticipated. And there were some plan changes that WMATA made to reduce future costs of the program. Okay, so that drove those costs down. In the 2015 valuation, the actual costs were a little bit higher than I expected, and the projection for future medical costs went up. And so that caused the 2016 obligations to go up. Overall, though, WMATA has a meaningful obligation for retiree medical benefits. It's roughly about $2 billion is what we're anticipating when we do the July 1, 2017 valuation, which we're in the process of completing right now. So that's the number to keep in mind, that the obligation for commitments that have been made is roughly about $2 billion.
Okay. Before you go on to the change in accounting standards, could you just address how many retirees are covered by this program right now?
Sure.
And what's the length of the program? I don't want to get into mortality and tables, but obligation out there?
So let me share with you a couple of stats. Hopefully that gets to that question. Okay. First of all, it's a great question. This program includes retirees who are currently collecting benefits, as well as active employees who at some point when they retire will be eligible to receive benefits. The total pool is about 12,500 participants, of which about 6,900 are active employees, and roughly, I believe, about 5,700 are retirees. So that's the first data point, I think, that you asked about. In terms of sort of the length or tail, one way to look at it is how long do you expect to pay out benefits for? And if we do a cash flow projection on this plan, you're looking at least a good 70 years that WMATA will be paying out benefits to retirees, both current as well as future.
70.
Okay. So the tail is pretty far, pretty long. Does that help answer the questions that you asked? Any other questions before I proceed to the accounting changes? No? Okay, excellent. So, before before we get into the implications of the accounting changes, so some of the reasons as to why. So this, as I said, is a new government accounting standard. It's GASB 75. There was a similar change that was made a couple of years ago, which impacted pension plans, and WMATA has adopted that. So there's a similarity in this one as well as what was adopted in the past. The reason for making this change is to provide for readers of the financial statements with more clarity or transparency in terms of the information related to the obligations that an entity has. So what that means is that there are greater disclosures that are required about the benefits, about the changes in the benefits, and also the obligations are, disclosures related to funding and how the entity intends to fund these obligations. There's also, because there is a desire to have bond analysts and others be able to tell from a market basis what these obligations are and what the commitment is, there's a movement towards using more market-based assumptions. Okay, so, for example, the interest rate will be based on, it's not corporate bond rates, it's going to be based on municipal bond rates. And there are some changes in the municipal bond rate that you can reflect if the plan is funded. If it's not funded, then it's pure municipal bond rates. Okay. So it's a fairly conservative measure that's going to take place, but it's changes every year based on the on the rate when the valuation is done. So in our case, if we're doing a valuation on July 1, 2017, we would look at the municipal bond rates for your plan as of that date. When we do the 2018 valuation, we would look at it at that point. So you're going to see some volatility in these costs, more so than you've seen in the past. Okay? So you would see some jump because if the interest rates go up, the present value of those obligations goes down, as you can appreciate. And if the interest rates go down, then the present value is higher. It's almost like a stream of bond payments. That's how this obligation is measured. Okay? So there's much more reflection of that. And as I said, there needs to be now a defined, if you're going to have a funding strategy, you're required to disclose that in your CAFR, what that strategy is. And then, of course, every year when the plan is being audited, I would suspect that the auditors would be looking at that strategy to determine whether that funding is taking place. And if so, if the interest rate is based on reflecting that, then some of those would be looked at as well. Okay? So some of the key things to keep in mind, as I mentioned before, the obligation roughly is about $2 billion. It's not as if this number has not been on the WMATA CAFRs before, because when we looked at the prior slide, and I showed you the $1.8 billion number as of July 1, 2017. That was on your financial statements. The only thing is that on your financial statements in the past, under the current standard, what's shown as the ultimate liability is the accumulated expenses for the plan, less contributions that have been made. The difference between that, so that was about $700,000. The difference between that and the $1.8 billion liability is deferred items. So they're there, but they're not as evident. As we go forward starting this fiscal year, you'll actually be showing the $2 billion number, okay? So it's, again, as I said, it's not that it's not been there before, it's just become much more pronounced and available there to look at. And as we talked about the fact that there's going to be more volatility because of the interest rate, one way to mitigate that, actually, is by funding the plan. So if you are able to fund the plan and able to disclose the funding strategy, then when we set the discount rate, it's not just purely based on the municipal bond rates. We're able to reflect what the anticipated earnings on that funding is going to be in the trust based on your investment strategy, and that would allow for a slightly higher interest rate to be reflected. Okay? So that's why funding, again, always an area of concern because these obligations, as I said, have a tail of almost 70 years, 70, 80 years. Your current funding, you have it on a pay-as-you-go basis, is roughly about $50 million. So that's what WMATA is paying out to retirees, and that will increase over time. We would, as you can appreciate, as people age and become retired and collect more and more benefits, we would expect that number to increase substantially over the next 5 to 10 years. Okay? So if there's a desire to fund, then it would be a good thing to look at now and begin to reflect that potentially. So that kind of leads us to a conversation around the establishment of a trust. So again, should I turn it over to you? Yeah?
Thanks. So with respect to the trust, when the board approved the FY18 budget, the board also authorized the general manager and CEO to establish a
benefit trust using savings from reduced absenteeism and as well as reduced overtime. The trust, as Mr. Alkerin mentioned, will leverage the capital markets to hopefully reduce the $1.8 billion of unfunded OPEB liability that he just spoke about. I should note, though, also that recently the general manager also took steps to reduce this liability by changing the healthcare plan for non-reps, as well as eliminating post-retirement healthcare from management employees going forward. Last March, therefore, WMATA started a new absenteeism policy, changing how absences are tracked and managed at WMATA. And so in addition to moving from it to a planned absence, if you will, it also changed how those absences are tracked on a more timely basis, provided clear guidelines, as well as expanded efforts around bringing employees back to work. And on the overtime side, management has been meeting and reviewing overtime on a monthly basis to better understand the purpose of the overtime and the necessity for the overtime. The good news is that as of January of this year, these efforts have reduced average employee absenteeism by 1.5% and resulted in 178 employees getting off of long-term absence status, where they were actually accruing benefits towards retirement. So overall, as of January, management has saved $5 million, including about $4 million in overtime due to more employees being present for work. So consistent with the resolution that the board adopted with respect to the FY18 budget, staff will proceed to establish an open trust funded at $3 million, hopefully by prior to May 1 of this year. That concludes our presentation. I'll be glad to respond to questions.
Thank you very much. Other questions by members of the committee or other members generally? Gentlemen? This is not an action item, so thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Very good. I believe Mr. Chairman Evans has to say something now.
Okay. It's a request for the executive session. In accordance with the bylaws, I, Jack Evans, request the Board of Directors convene an executive session to discuss the following matters pursuant to Article 2, Paragraph 9, Subsection B. Litigation, investigations, and other legal matters requiring the provision of legal advice or consultation with counsel and staff members, and H, development of WMATA position or strategy on pending or proposed federal or state legislation. So I'd like to move this request at this time. Is there a second? Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. We'll meet everyone upstairs right now. Thank you.
also throw in some authority to vary other terms of negotiations that come back to us as long as it's not a program redesign level thing. That makes sense to me.
For the, we wanted to put a BRT from, you know, Grosvenor Scott, Roy Flint, to the Westfield Montgomery Mall, and then we want to extend it to Virginia. Now, our plan, when they did the Silver Line EIS for phase one, we said make room in the Silver Line station for accommodating connection coming in along the Beltway.
This would go from where?
Well, it would go from the mall, Montgomery Mall.